employers have been brought to trial because they had a hiring preference for a veteran other than another civilian.
Legislation that would allow Alaskan businesses to hire a vet without the risk of going to court. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, January 24th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, legal work for the emerging marijuana business.
I just want to be more engaged in the public process and be able to be more of a boulder in the inside, not so much of a pebble on the outside.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com. Your health matters. Tuesday, January 31st, is the last day to enroll in Health Insurance Marketplace. Information at getcoveredalaska.org or call 1-844-PLANS-AK. This message sponsored by Alaska Primary Care Association.
When business owners seek to advertise that they want to hire military veterans, they face an obstacle. People who aren't veterans can sue them for discrimination. State Representative Chris Tuck wants to change that. Tuck has introduced House Bill 2, which would allow private employers to openly use a veteran hire preference if they choose to.
Employers know that when military people are discharged, they come with some great skills and abilities through their training.
The Federal Civil Rights Act provides that states can allow public and private employers to legally hire preference hire for veterans. While all 50 states allow the veterans preference for public employers, Alaska is one of 13 states that hasn't allowed it for private employers. Tuck says business owners' concerns are valid.
Employers have been brought to trial because they've had a hiring preference for a veteran other than another civilian.
Russ Ball owns ACB Solutions, an Anchorage small business that provides computer repair and other computer services statewide. He says he's worried about a discrimination suit from an unsuccessful applicant. Ball supports Tuck's bill.
We find the military or the veterans to be good workers, to be skilled workers, but we also see it as a way of saying thank you for their service.
The House Military and Veterans Affairs Committee discussed the bill today. Tuck says he would bring the legislation up again in a future meeting. Officials with the U.S. Defense Department and the State Department of Military and Veterans Affairs support the bill. 1 in 10 Alaskans is a veteran, the highest per capita share of any state's population. It's a tricky time for commercial cannabis in Alaska. Stores around the state are beginning to open, but without enough product available to keep shelves stocked for more than a few hours. The state's largest market, Anchorage, is seeing delays for businesses because of complicated zoning regulations. And there are concerns that a Justice Department under the Trump administration may reverse tolerant federal guidelines. At the center of all this is an emerging legal niche. Pot lawyers. Alaska Public Media's Zechariah Hughes reports.
On the wall of her Midtown office, Jana Weltzien shows off two abstract pictures made by her high school best friend.
She did these, and it's actually wax. I'm not supposed to touch it, but I touch it. And it's called Breathe In and Out.
Weltzien grew up in Fairbanks, but went to law school and started practicing in Arizona. After Alaskans voted in favor of a recreational cannabis industry in 2014, she saw an opportunity.
Marijuana law is something that is so exciting and interesting to me because we're never going to see something like this happen again in my lifetime. We're never going to see an industry come up that has never existed before.
Weltzien is only 30. Young for a lawyer who's already had a large role shaping the regulations for a brand new business sector. If she'd been born 15 years earlier, she'd probably be counseling tech startups in Silicon Valley. Instead, her cannabis clients stretch from Aniak to the Rail Belt, Fairbanks, all the way down to Kisilov, with even a few in the lower 48. According to Weltzien, most of her clients are mom-and-pop operations, in no small part because that's who's willing to take the risk in commercial pot's murky legal landscape.
The cannabis industry throughout the states that have legalized has been largely born from small entrepreneurial startups, and you're never going to see that again. I mean, the risk keeps out the big boys.
Weltzien herself took a risk. Though she doesn't specify how much money she's making now, she says the business is profitable and that she's doing better than when she collected a six-figure salary as an assistant attorney at the Rose Law Group, a large corporate firm in Arizona. There, she got experience in Arizona's medicinal marijuana industry, which happens to involve a lot of rules over building and development.
Just like here, there's a whole land use component to the cannabis market there, where you have to get, you know, special use permits, there's requirements for buffers, there's multiple city hearings and public hearings. So same kind of process we're going through here.
Waltzien's been a vocal presence at the state level in guiding legislation through Juneau, as well as giving input on the regulations as they've been written. But she's also willingly been sucked into much more local battles in Anchorage over assembly ordinances and zoning codes. The mayor's office is trying to appoint her to a vacant seat on the city's platting board, one of the most important yet dull local bodies governing land use.
I just want to be more engaged in the public process and be able to, you know, be more of a boulder in the inside, not so much of a pebble on the outside.
The former head of the Marijuana Control Board, Bruce Schulte, wrote in an email that Waltzien was the most credible legal counsel in the state when it comes to setting up new pot businesses, although he added that the pool is still quite small. Like many of her Anchorage clients, Waltzien is frustrated that the city's building code is proving to be such a stumbling block for new businesses, even if it's a snag that she happens to financially benefit from. Still, she's impressed by the speed with which the legal industry has come into existence and the unique victories that have been won in Alaska for measures like on-site consumption.
This is fun. I mean, this is way fun. This is, like, probably the most exciting, like, fun, fulfilling 2 years that I've had, period.
For now, Waltzien's attention is firmly fixed on cannabis laws, which she sees as a pillar of economic development. Amid a new industry facing an uncertain future in the last frontier, she's a bit of a pioneer, staking a claim that could be either a bonanza or a bust. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Recent heavy snow accumulation is pushing moose onto Alaska roads. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, that's increasing collision danger.
When snow piles up, you're more likely to encounter moose on roads.
Along the Parks Highway from Big Lake to Talkeetna, I counted 40 moose.
Alaska Moose Federation Director Don Dyer says he saw the animals while driving the 50-mile stretch of highway last week. Dyer says deep snow has moose moving to where the going is easier.
It's tough for them to walk in the forest and, you know, the other areas, and so then they resort to walking on the roads.
Dyer says about 400 moose are killed by vehicles on Alaska roads every winter, most in the Kenai and Mat-Su areas, but some in Fairbanks as well. The nonprofit Moose Federation salvages roadkill moose and provides the meat to charities. Dyer says roadkills have tracked a little under normal this winter, but numbers are increasing with the snowpack.
There's been more activity in Fairbanks. Not as much as that, too, but it's definitely been an uptick in moose collisions.
Dyer says the situation could get worse if a crust forms on the snow, making it even more difficult for moose to get around. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska State Troopers are investigating a fatal shooting in Soldotna. Troopers, shortly before 9 p.m. on Sunday, received a report of a home invasion and shooting in the city. The Troopers Alaska Bureau of Investigation took charge of the case. The Bureau announced Monday it's treating the incident as a homicide investigation. Troopers say details released will be limited because of the nature of the investigation. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Pat Porchot on that time he led John McPhee down the Salmon River for coming into the country.
I think he just really captures things so entertainingly and accurately.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the 2017 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Teacher nomination forms available at bpteachers.com.
Artists, show us how you inspire Alaska. Apply now for an individual artist award. Deadline is March 1st. Learn more at rasmussen.org/IAA. This message sponsored by Rasmussen Foundation.
After receiving well more than 2 feet of snow over the weekend, the city of Seward has declared a local emergency. City Clerk Johanna Kinney says crews have been working around the clock to dig out the community.
There's a big urgent need to get our roads clear and accessible. And then at the same time, the concern is starting to also go towards the integrity of the structures in town.
Kinney says the city is urging residents to keep a close eye on their property.
Whether it's a boat or a shed, their residence, anything that could be in question for a weight capacity with this conditions.
The emergency declaration requests assistance from the Kenai Peninsula Borough and state agencies, but Kinney says help is not yet on the way from either entity.
At this point, no outside resources available to us because the weather is affecting everybody right now.
And Kinney says the city is concerned conditions will worsen with warmer weather and rain in the forecast later this week. Jason Ossenmacher, a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Anchorage, says temperatures are predicted to reach into the 40s.
As early as Wednesday midday, we're going to be seeing rain and snow showers turning to all rain for the Seward area.
Ossenmacher says the area could receive more than an inch of rain. He says the weather front on Thursday is likely to bring light rain and Chinook winds to Anchorage. The collapse of the Dome, an Anchorage sports complex over the weekend, has left some people wondering whether their own roofs can withstand the weight of the recent heavy snowfall. As APRN's Josh Edge reports, most homeowners should be okay for now.
Mike Martin is the board chairman for Anchorage Sportsplex, Inc., the Dome. He says exactly what caused the facility to collapse on Saturday is still under investigation, but snow appears to be a significant factor.
We're also trying to determine whether or not there are other factors, and if so, what they are. There's a lot of things that go into keeping the Dome standing and inflated, and including management of the snow load.
The Dome opened in 2006 and has survived heavy snowfall in the past. But does the Dome collapse mean Anchorage residents should shovel their own roofs? Kent Kohlhase is the acting building official for the municipality of Anchorage. He says snow loads are still fairly light, and while homes should not be in imminent danger, he says it is a good idea for residents to keep an eye on their roofs.
They know best the issues that they may have had in the past with their homes, with things such as ice damming and water leaks and things like that, and where snow may drift and pile up. So really, a homeowner should always take the time to monitor things.
Even with warmer temperatures and a chance for rain later in the week, Kohlhase says it is unlikely the snow load will reach a dangerous weight. But if you do clear off your roof, Kohlhase urges caution. He also recommends leaving a buffer of snow.
Certainly be very careful, and we'd recommend against using an ice chipper, but leaving that snow provides a layer of protection. It also provides for better footing for somebody when they're up on a pitched roof.
Kohlhase says the municipality is working with officials at the Dome to determine the cause of the structure's collapse. Though there's no precise timetable, Mike Martin says the Dome can and will be repaired.
The manufacturer has indicated that the damage, to whatever degree it is repairable, and that we will do so as quickly as possible.
Until then, Martin says other organizations have reached out to provide temporary space to some Dome users, which number in the thousands each week during the winter. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
A young man from the Bristol Bay community of Igigik has been given a 20-month jail sentence after he pleaded guilty to possession with intent to distribute more than 3 pounds of methamphetamines. 21-year-old Jason Corey Vincent Alto was caught May 30th last year while he was traveling on the ferry vessel Kennecott from Washington State toward Whittier. The U.S. Coast Guard and State Trooper Drug Enforcement cooperated on the bust, which happened in Ketchikan. Jack Schmidt is the Assistant U.S. Attorney in the Juneau office who prosecuted the case in federal court.
Mr. Alto had been carrying in excess of 3 pounds of methamphetamine on the Alaska State Ferry, and just happenstance that when he disembarked in Ketchikan, he exhibited signs that he was potentially a drug trafficker. He was contacted, and they got a warrant and a dog hit on his luggage, which contained the 3 pounds of methamphetamine.
That much meth could have been cut into about 5,000 doses. Its street value depended on where it ended up in the state, which Schmidt says he doesn't know. He does say it's the largest ever meth seizure in Southeast Alaska.
Typically, we have people dealing in ounces, maybe in the half-pound range. It's highly unusual to see, you know, anything above a kilo, which is about 2.2 pounds, and here it was nearly 3 pounds.
Alto, then a 21-year-old with substance abuse problems, was classified as a drug mule, responsible for trafficking the narcotics, but likely not for dealing them. Schmidt had asked for nearly 3 times as much jail time as Judge Timothy Burgess handed down.
I thought that, you know, sending a message was an important aspect of the case, given the quantity of the amount of drugs, but, you know, the defendant had a fairly minimal criminal history, and he was young, and so I think those are the things that the judge had taken into consideration in fashioning the sentence the way he did.
According to reporting in the Juneau Empire, Alto told the judge he plans to return to Igigik to study to become a commercial pilot. He is in custody and will serve the remainder of his 20 months in jail before beginning 5 years of supervised release. The state government is gearing up for the battle against opioid addiction. Andy Jones, the section chief for the Department of Health and Social Services, is heading up a new statewide program to get the drug naloxone, also known by its commercial name Narcan, into the hands of heroin users no matter where they live. Alaska recently received a $4.2 million grant for a 5-year Project Hope program from the federal government's Department of Health and Human Services.
And what that equates to is about 5,000 of these life-saving kits every year.
Jones says it was a fight just getting the funds because the opioid epidemic is not only here, it's also in the lower 48, where the number of deaths far exceeds those dying from heroin overdoses in Alaska.
If you look at 1 or 2 or 3 deaths, people in the lower 48 look at that as like, that's not significant. But that's not true. That's really significant to that community because they have a smaller population and they know each other. Those are their loved ones. And so we won that battle, which is exciting.
Since getting the money 2.5 months ago, Jones's team has developed kits with education and training materials and a simple drug delivery system to keep people alive when they are overdosing.
You know, if you ever have an allergy and you squirt up some type of anti-allergy up your nose, we're all familiar with that, right? It's very easy, the same concept. I actually taught my 3-year-old daughter how to use it. And when I did that, I was like, this is it.
This system, provided free through Project Hope, is not cheap. Buying it at a pharmacy costs $150 per dose. The same drug delivered through a needle costs a lot less, $20 to $30 per dose. Jones wants to work with health organizations, community groups, tribes, or anyone willing to help get the medicine to heroin drug users when they need it.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 tons, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. If you're a rural Alaska resident, consider applying for a seat on the Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council by Friday, February 3rd, 2017. Applicants with knowledge of regional subsistence uses, customs, and traditions are needed. Council meetings serve as a forum for subsistence management. More at 1-800-478-1456. This message sponsored by your Federal Subsistence Board and the U.S. Departments of the Interior and Agriculture.
When it comes to picking a good place to socialize, the bathroom probably isn't high on your list. But for coastal river otters in south central Alaska, the bathroom is a major social hub. Researchers are now working to understand how otters use these latrine sites to communicate and build social groups. KBBI's Shayla Farzan reports.
Alaskan river otters have a somewhat unusual social system. The females spend most of their time alone, and the males hang out in groups. It's basically the animal world's version of a guy's night out.
They will play with each other and swim together and wash themselves and gently gnaw at each other's fur and groom each other.
That's Adi Barocas. He's a doctoral student at the University of Wyoming, and he's fascinated by otter social groups. The most popular spots for male otters to gather are latrine sites. In other words, spots where they defecate and urinate. For you or I, using the bathroom is just a basic and sometimes inconvenient part of being alive. But for otters, it's like a language. A single sniff of feces can tell an otter a lot about another individual, their sex, dominant status, even what they've been eating. To help understand how latrines affect otter behavior, Barocca set up cameras along coastline in Kenai Fjords National Park and Prince William Sound. When the otters visited a latrine site, the movement triggered the camera to start recording. The cameras recorded the otters doing something strange right before they defecate. Barocca calls it the poop dance.
The otters raised their tails, sort of a pretty high angle in the air, and then they'll give a few stomps with their feet.
It's not clear why the otters do the poop dance, but it seems to have a domino effect. When one otter does a poop dance, it triggers other otters to do it. Barocca also noticed that otters tended to congregate at centralized latrine sites, where multiple trails cross over.
Because we've seen more large groups in the crossovers may be the station where small social units come and hang out together, gather information, and decide which animals do I want to hang out with.
At these centralized latrines, otters performed signaling behaviors, like the poop dance, more than social behaviors, like grooming. Barocca says these latrine sites might help otters pick which social group to join. In other words, these centralized latrines might be the otters' version of a high school dance, a place where lots of individuals come together, judge each other, and pick which group to join. It's too soon to say how exactly these latrine sites affect otter social behavior. Barocca and his colleagues will continue to monitor the otters, hoping to unravel that mystery. In Homer, I'm Shayla Farzon.
John McPhee's book, Coming Into the Country, starts with a river trip. 6 men, 9 days, floating nearly the entire length of the Salmon River in northwest Alaska. The 26-year-old leading the trip was Pat Porchot, a recent Alaska transplant who had the job of a lifetime with the Interior Department. Porchot says McPhee's book helped focus national attention on the effort to preserve large sections of Alaska's wilderness. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Annie Feit has the story.
As Pat Porchot tells it, fresh out of college, he lucked into one of the best jobs in the world. In 1972, he was working for the now long-gone Federal Bureau of Outdoor Recreation in Colorado. His boss needed 5 people willing to relocate to Alaska. The job, floating and researching rivers across the state to see if they would qualify for wild and scenic status in the national park system.
I had wanted to go to Alaska since I was a little kid, and I couldn't raise my hand fast enough and got off the plane here in the spring of 1972 and basically never left.
The Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act had passed the year before as part of the effort in Congress to make way for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Besides establishing 12 Alaska Native regional corporations, the law called for studying wilderness areas in the state for national designation as refuges and parks. That's where Porchot came in. He had almost no experience in a kayak or canoe, but he was part of the team charged with inspecting more than 24 remote rivers across the state.
And we were looking for, I think the words were, remarkably outstanding values.
By 1975, when John McPhee showed up in Alaska, Porchot was a skilled paddler. McPhee had a good friend who was a colleague of Porchot's at the Interior Department, and he convinced the writer to come to Alaska for a story. Porchot had never heard of the New Yorker magazine and didn't have any idea who John McPhee was. But on the trip, McPhee quickly gained Porchot's respect. Porchot says he asked intricate questions about the landscape and animals and probed the men for their opinions on wilderness and conservation.
Was he, like, furiously taking notes the whole time?
Not furiously, continually, I would say, and short notes. It seemed like, especially in the evening around the campfire, he would be taking notes. Lunch breaks, he'd be taking notes.
When the New Yorker article was published in May 1977, Porchot marveled at the way McPhee unraveled the story of their 9-day adventure. The trip started near the headwaters of the Salmon, where the river was barely more than a foot deep. McPhee writes, "I was not disappointed the salmon was low. In a lifetime of descending rivers, this was the clearest and the wildest river. Walking it in places made it come slow, and that was a dividend in itself." In one especially vivid section, McPhee describes an epic battle between Porchot and a giant chum salmon.
Porchot casts again, nothing. He casts again. The lure this time stops in the river as if it were encased in cement. Could be a boulder, could be a submerged log. The lure seems irretrievably snagged until the river erupts.
Does it bring you back to that?
Yeah. And John McPhee's accuracy is impeccable. I think he just really captures things so entertainingly and accurately.
When Coming Into the Country was published in December 1977, it quickly became a bestseller. Porchot says McPhee's book doesn't explicitly make the case for conservation, but it brought the remote wilds of Alaska into focus for readers.
What it did was raise a nation's consciousness about Alaska and the stakes and what was going on and what should the role of conservation be on our public lands in Alaska. And I think that's where undoubtedly it had an effect.
In 1980, the Salmon River was included in the National Wild and Scenic River System, along with two dozen other rivers Porchot's team floated. After his brush with McPhee, Porchot worked as a congressional staffer, state lawmaker, and DNR commissioner, to name a few of his many public service jobs. He's now retired, but he hasn't stopped exploring. Porchot says he leads a small group of aging buddies on river trips in Alaska every summer.
It's been kind of a pleasant surprise that most of the places that I've revisited are largely the same. Yeah, it's been nice. I think you can go out to the gates of the Arctic, or you can go to the Beaver Creek in the Yukon Flats Wildlife Refuge and have an experience that's very similar to the experience we had in the 70s. So that's a good thing.
And when he's off the river, he still hears from people who've just read Coming Into the Country and want to know if he's the same Pat Porchot who led John McPhee on the Salmon River more than 40 years ago. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Zachariah Hughes, Johanna Yurick, Josh Edge, and Annie Feit in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Dave Benninger in Dillingham, and Shayla Farzan in Homer. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
As it turns out, you don't need to wear a cape to save the community or a giant S on your chest to stand up for what's right. That's because the University of Alaska is working to build a better future for our state. Through education, the university is developing a skilled workforce with more teachers, engineers, and nurses to move Alaska forward. Join the university in leading the change Alaska needs. Visit drivechangeak.org to learn more. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska. January 31st is the last day to enroll in the Health Insurance Marketplace. For assistance in your area, go to getcoveredalaska.org or call 1-844-PLANS-AK. This message sponsored by Alaska Primary Care Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.